This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is brought to you by AppRiver. Are you moving your business to Office 365? Working the cloud can make your life a lot easier. But getting help, that's another story. That's why you should try AppRiver. They have one of the most experienced support teams in the business. You'll get free US-based support from folks who care about helping you and actually know how. And if you're going with Office 365, go with AppRiver. Try AppRiver services free for 30 days by going to appriver.com/test. That's appriver.com/test.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, October 25th, 2 days before our live show, 3 days before our live show, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of tested.com. Welcome, everyone, to a very busy week at the Tested office. Indeed, I'm Norm, joined by Jeremy Williams.
Hello, Norman.
And hello, good morning. And a very special guest returning for third time on the podcast, Zach Ratting. How are you doing, Zach?
I'm excellent. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. And thank you for joining us. Kishore is taking this week off because he is busier than anyone we know.
He's not taking the week off.
No. Just from the podcast, he runs the Bay Area Science Festival, which our live show is a part of. So he is actually frantically making phone calls, setting things up, making things happen. So we can have a great week of festivities.
That's business as usual for Kishore.
That is. Absolutely.
He's just extra busy.
Yes. Yeah. And he listens to the podcast too. So maybe he'll appreciate all the kudos we're giving him. Thank you, Kishore. But Zach, how are things going?
How have you been? Excellent. Things are busy as always. Busy with work, busy with fun, you know, building lots of things.
Zach
is a builder.
I am a builder.
A professional maker of things.
I do. That's what pays my bills.
Yeah. So if you missed any of the past two episodes that Zach was a guest here, quick overview, you are a contract for hire, maker, designer,
prototyper of
physical objects.
Exactly. So mechanical, electronic, you name it. If you need a thing, I'm good at making those things.
You found a way to make making a profession.
I know, I did. Somehow. I just kind of kept doing it and then figured out somebody that would pay me for it.
Build cool stream.
Yeah. Build cool stuff. That's your website.
Buildcoolstuff.com.
So what do people come to you for? What have people come to you for that you can talk about recently?
All the reasons. I know that's always the hard one in like the product development or any kind of development. It's like, oh yeah, nobody wants you to talk about their stuff. I can more talk about the stuff that I always come up with. I mean, that's the easy one.
You still do plenty of side projects.
Oh, yeah.
Fun projects on your own.
Absolutely. I love making, puzzles and games. And last time I was here, we talked about, I built a camping trailer, a little teardrop trailer. That's all done.
Wow.
Done is a relative term. Like all projects that are passion projects, you always want to improve. You kind of, you look at it, you use it a couple times and go, oh, well, if I had more shelves or more drawers or more whatever,
right.
I need to add more solar power is really what the,
Oh, does it have solar panels?
It has solar panels. There's a refrigerator in the back so I can keep my ice cream cold when I'm out in the desert.
Nice.
Very important.
So you took it to Burning Man.
I did take it. That was kind of ended up being a Burning Man project, even though it didn't start out that way. It was like up to the last minute right before the night I left was working on the trailer.
Had a dramatic shortage of LEDs if it was really a Burning Man project.
Yeah, no LEDs or not nearly enough LEDs, yeah. And probably not no fur, no fun accessories. But it was actually really great for the desert. It kept me cool.
That was a stress test
for this, right?
You drove it all the way out there. I lived in it.
Absolutely. I found all the loose bolts as I went. I kept I would drive about, 2 hours and then go around and check all the bolts, make sure they're still tight. Actually found a couple loose ones. So, it was a good stress test. It worked and looking forward to keep using it.
Congrats, man.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Yeah. Where does it live now?
It lives in the corner of my shop. So it's,
did you take it through a big car wash when you came back?
I did. I took it through a car wash and then still spent, you know, a good couple hours finding all the dust, the playa dust that seems to hide everywhere. There's still playa dust. You never get rid of playa dust. It's kind of like matter. You cannot destroy it. You only move it from one place to another.
Yeah, everyone, right after Burning Man, the price goes up. The price goes double.
If you came
from Burning Man, your car wash is going to cost a little bit more. If you go to Zach's website, that's buildcoolstuff.com, there's a projects page. And look, and it has some of the projects that I think you can talk about or share some info about.
Some of those. In fact, I don't even remember what's up there.
It's really funny because a lot of these products are things that we've used or have even used recently. For example, we were just toying around with the structure sensor a couple weeks ago, and you did some work for that.
That's been 4 or 5 years ago because, I come in the beginning of the design cycle, so by the time it actually makes it to market, I mean, it's still a couple years old as a product, but... it's a cool little device. So I worked on some of the original interface to the PrimeSense sensor, some of the battery stuff, some of the communication with the iPhone or iOS device. I did some of the board layout in there. It was a really fun project. And actually, that was the first time I got to play with structured light, sensing. So 3D sensing through projection of lots of little dots and learning how that all works, and that's it's a pretty cool technique for scanning things.
That's in a lot of things now.
It was in
Kinect, and it's in basically your iPhone will have a similar feature. Throwing those dots in your face.
30,000 dots.
30,000 dots, exactly. Yeah, staring into those lasers. And then they have to do a lot of things to make sure that you don't get blind by that or it doesn't burn itself up. There's actually, I don't know about in the iPhone, but I know in the PrimeSense sensor there's like active cooling. You know, because the little laser diode takes, you know, so much energy to send out that much light. So there's all kinds of complexity in it. So
Norm mentioned a project last week about computer vision, not PrimeSense, but just standard computer vision, a computer playing pinball.
Oh yes,
and that made me want to do that for real. I mean,
we should do that.
That seems like
yes.
That seems like
would
a project that could.
That? Would you need depth sensing for that?
No.
Right. It depends on the game, but
I don't think so.
There's not too many. I guess you can assume if there's multi levels.
Yeah.
Yeah, you probably can figure that out.
Okay. But. Well, so let's run you through the story here. I was at an event, Science Hack Day, hackathon, 2-day event, and one of the projects that came out of the city event was a pinball robot that had a webcam looking just at the flippers. So like the bottom, you know, fifth of the pinball, the play field. And they coded it enough so that if the ball got close to the flipper before it went to the hole, it would activate.
Yeah,
the solenoid.
Absolutely.
I think that's the beginning.
That's the proof of concept.
Right.
I mean, you can think of all the ways as pinball nerds. You guys think of all the ways that you need to strategize, like the end goal, like what your brain is going through as you're watching a ball run around the play field. But even the bare minimum of looking down at the flippers, the things you'd want to measure. Angle, velocity, vector, do those calculations, that non-trivial.
Well, it is and it isn't. That's the cool thing about technology these days. Like, there's so much, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, with OpenCV and sort of all these packages for doing that sort of vision processing. And then, you know, you can easily build up those things with kind of off-the-shelf hardware now. I mean, again, 10 years ago, it was really hard. But now you can do it in a weekend or even in a couple hours and get the basics. But then what's the real magic is taking the brain out of, you know, somebody that is a pinball wizard and making it actually good.
So that's the question. Would you do it that way? Would you take all of Jeremy's knowledge and his experience?
You couldn't
of
fit that in a computer.
Or would you let the system machine learn?
Yeah, like the Atari experiment where they didn't teach the game how to play the Atari 2600 games. They just said, computer, here's an Atari 2600, learn how to play it.
The beauty with pinball is the metric is pretty easy. Keep the ball in play and try to score.
Watch the score.
And it has a metric built in. So, it's almost a perfect AI computer learning, you know, setup. I think that'd be a fun project.
It's not about needing to get the high score in this amount of time. As long as you keep it alive.
There's no time limit.
There's no time. Well, I guess the thing you couldn't account for is the slots on the side, the holes in the side. Like, you'd want to find a way, you'd want the machine learning to find a way to get you the trajectories and velocities to not, because that's an area where you have no control over.
Well, I guess, you know, a player is constantly nudging the table. So with the AI.
Ooh, would you put a nudge?
Constantly nudging the table?
Constantly.
What does that mean?
Walking the line between tilt and nudging.
What? How would you describe the difference between a tilt and a nudge?
A tilt, your ball's over. That's that, because the tilt sensor in there, there's actually a little tilt bob that swings,
right,
a
right,
pendulum.
Right, right. So your whole body is braced against the table.
Yeah, well, that's in there because if you shake the game, it's an advantage. So you'll make the ball last longer.
So are you micro nudges? Like what is this?
I don't know. What is the computer capable of doing?
Wow, that's a lot. The other project that I wanted to call out, I actually enjoyed some of this yesterday. You work for Smitten Ice Cream?
I did. It's in fact, I'm actually wearing some Smitten swag.
Oh, you are? I didn't notice that.
I know, right?
Okay.
I have a lot of free t-shirts.
I didn't put those two together.
Are they a sponsor?
No.
No, but I was in... They opened a new shop in the Mission.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was a pop-up. We actually covered... So for people who don't know, and we had a lot of requests about like recommendations for things to do if you're in San Francisco or if you're in the Bay Area, because there are so many things to do. And one of the things I always tell people is that we have a lot of... We're kind of like peak boutique ice cream right now. Like
there's even a museum.
My wife's going today.
A pop-up.
I think it was after peak coffee, right? Once small batch coffee was over.
Now that's so mainstream.
I know.
Yeah.
Now it's about small batch ice cream. But we had covered back in 2012 when they had their first pop-up. Mm-hmm. It was built out of a shipping container.
Yeah.
It was... Robin Sue Fisher. Yeah,
yep.
That's right, the founder. She had started this liquid nitrogen LN2 ice cream machine shop, and now they have like storefronts. And so I went to one yesterday, and I didn't realize you had worked on it. So what did you do for them?
I did a number of things over the years, kind of helped with their whole process and kind of improved their machines. The ice cream is sort of one piece of it, but they're actually a technology company in addition to just making really good ice cream. So they've actually built these custom machines to make their ice cream. They call them Burr machines with lots of R's.
Right. I remember back when they were called the Kelvin.
Oh, well, yes. That's a few versions ago.
Yeah.
But I actually helped work on the machines and some of the algorithms that are in there in between the conversion from Kelvin to the Burr, and then help them gather data so that they can monitor their machines and send out recipes to different shops. And
I didn't realize that whole infrastructure was built in there.
There's a whole lot of infrastructure. Yeah, yeah.
Because for recipes, it's not just about the rate at which you pour.
It's all they
the
have all kinds of
flavors.
All kinds of factors to make that perfect, perfect scoop of ice cream. And they really take the time to do it. And they're really perfectionists when it comes to their ice cream. So it really shows
the design. And they are not a sponsor, but I love the design of their their storefront, because like how fancy can you make and how high tech can you make an ice cream shop? But if you walk in, first of all, they have like, you see a giant liquid nitrogen tank in the back, just
but
like exposed.
But it's not a high-tech shop at all. It has this really good homey kind of like country feel, but mixed with this.
Right, but it's exposed. It's like,
yeah,
it's like going to a brewery and you see the vats, you see the, and then on the outside, you actually see where like the truck pulls up
yeah,
and you plug it in. And
if you come early in the morning, you'll see that kind of all frosted over because it's just in the
reload.
Yeah.
That's cool.
No, it's a really fun store, not just because they're a customer of mine. And it's just kind of a neat organization. They make really good ice cream.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
We're not going to go into the full conversation of like how you got to do what you got to do, but
someday we'll get into that.
Yeah, let's talk about some pop culture news.
You want to go to a live show? No.
Oh, well, yes. Mentioned at the top, our live show is this Saturday. That's what we're all planning on right now. Everyone in this room is going to be there, either be on stage or to watch, and we hope to see you there. It's in San Francisco at the Castro Theater. There's still some tickets available, I think, at tested2017.eventbrite.com.
Hope to see you there.
And Sean and Jeremy have a project that they tested yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
Yep.
Very excited.
It means 100% it will work on stage.
But
that's what that means, right?
That's the way it always works.
Right?
But the excitement, 100%. Your confidence, the amount of confidence you felt was worrying.
Yes.
To you.
Well, the fact that I felt confident was definitely worrying.
Because that means
that is not
Murphy's
normal.
Law is going to play an effect and something's going to potentially go wrong. So be there for that. And if you're not at our live show, I assume the only thing you're going to be doing is probably watching Stranger Things 2.
Yeah.
Which comes out this Friday.
Or you'll be hung over from watching it the night before.
Yeah.
So do you binge watch it or do you make it last?
You know, I'm of the mind you got to make this one last.
Mm.
I mean, it's such a big deal. So the reviews reviews have come out for the second season, and they have been glowing. I have not read the actual reviews. I've just read the summary that the reviews are great. So I'm like, that's all I need to know. Right. I don't want to.
Only the headlines.
I don't trust the review. Like, even the spoiler free reviews give too much.
Yep.
And they're trying their clever ways to avoid spoilers. But the timing is perfect. It's coming out like right before Halloween.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, spend my entire Sunday watching this show and like burning myself out. I'm going to take maybe two episodes at a time.
Why do you think they do these reviews? This was such a hit. Netflix.
I think the reviews are to get people who, I mean, even though Netflix views ubiquitous, there's still a lot of growth to be had, even in the United States.
You mean for subscriptions?
Yeah. Yeah. And they want to make sure the people who are subscribed are going to watch everything, even if they're not in the quote-unquote target market.
Yeah, but don't you think that there would have been enough reviews if they hadn't released it early? That the people who professionally write for papers and websites, that they would have reviewed it?
Marketing companies have to exist for a reason.
I was going to say, the marketing for, I think it's still that engine that is still based on, you know, how movies are released. It's like, okay, if we have initial focus groups that say it's good, okay, then we'll let it out a week early to get to reviewers.
Right, right.
And you can always tell those movies that are going to be flops because there's no mention of the reviews. Yeah, so
well, like there are a lot of, like, Netflix has a, I don't know if it's a problem, I mean, even South Park made the joke that they approve everything and they're just buying up shows and producing so much, but they have, there's so much that goes by because it is the binge method, right? And like Stranger Things may be the hot thing this week and we may be building up to it, but it may be something completely different. But they want to make cultural, they want to win awards. And they want to have cultural phenomenons. And like Stranger Things was a cultural phenomenon last year. So
for sure,
it makes sense for them to tap into that.
Now, why do you think, I mean, is there any advantage to them for people to binge watch it versus do an episode?
You're questioning their entire
model? No, their model is streaming content. And mm-hmm. But
the release schedule.
The release schedule. Like that has always kind of puzzled me. It's why I was like, you kind of think you would still have as many eyeballs, but if you stretch it out over a long period of time, but they just give us these like massive doses, and I almost get like an overload of media when they release these.
What it is for me is I feel competitive with everyone else.
To get caught up.
Because I want to be on track with everyone. There's something to be said for going into Tested 1 week and, you know, catching up on the latest Star Trek Discovery, because that's as far as you could go.
Right.
But here...
You can't.
Did you watch the whole season or not? How much can I talk about?
I think
with
they've made the calculated risk that the water cooler week to week is only valuable if you're an HBO model where you're producing, you're staggering all your releases. They want the value proposition to be so front and center.
But I guess it's anticipation once versus anticipation on a weekly basis, and I feel like that I miss that.
But anticipation on a weekly basis only is valuable on the HBO model if. You know you're not going to be – it's not 12 shows at the same time. It's like two or three at most staggered. You know Westworld's going to be this block,
two or three that you're interested in. They actually have a lot of content as well.
Right,
but.
Right. But Netflix, it's all stacked.
Yeah, yeah.
And
– Well, Voltron, they split up. They did two like seven-episode seasons about 6 months apart.
That I like that too.
Yeah.
I like splitting up. I think Star Trek Discovery is doing that as well, where they're taking a 13-episode, 14-episode season and splitting up the two halves.
Well, I think it's production companies playing it safe, because if it's a flop, then they're only spending – they're only doling out half their money at a time.
I think it's playing it safe for the subscription model too, because then you don't want people to just subscribe
– For that one.
For the 1 month.
Right. Oh, and then unsubscribe.
And then binge and then not be subscribed and then unsubscribe after the trial month, because they need to give people a reason –
To keep
stay
it
on for at least a year. Yeah, so they have those considerations.
Though if you look at my HBO subscription schedule, it obviously dips.
Oh, so you actually...
I do. I'm one of those people. I get my fix, and then I'm like, all right, well, now...
Well, that's why they sometimes make it very difficult for people to cancel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not easy for people to call in and cancel the cell phone subscription. But like HBO, I think is good at that.
They make it pretty easy.
They make it,
it's kind of nice.
Yeah.
It's almost on demand.
But they bank on most people just leaving it
being
on.
Being lazy.
Yeah, being lazy, and that's $15 a month. That's $15 a month.
Sounds like Audible. Audible's like they do the same thing. Like
In terms of like the credits.
The credits
accumulate.
Like the only way you should ever buy a book from Audible is as a member, because it's so much cheaper. And so I'll sign up to be a member, and then if I remember, I will cancel. But if I don't, 6 credits in my account.
Wow. And speaking of Star Trek Discovery, that has now been renewed for a second season.
All right.
So
is that surprising?
I think yes to me, because how expensive they said the show was going to cost.
Exactly.
Like $10 million an episode, or I don't know exactly. Maybe that's not for every episode, but in the multiple millions of dollars per episode is in that Game of Thrones, HBO price range, and CBS All Access is not. Does not have as high a stature, so as HBO Go or HBO. So
you have to wonder: are they making their money?
Apparently, they have been making enough to warrant it, and at least it's getting enough of making their service relevant. So right. I don't think it's going to. I don't think they're making it all the way back now. It's pure speculation on my part, but it makes their service relevant and gets people talking about it, so that when they're ready to announce more shows and fill the demographics.
Do we know that they're going to be doing more shows?
Okay. I think they're already doing two right now, and then their plan is,
who knows?
It's going forward. Yeah. Okay. They got to be filling those holes in.
Do you expect season one to come to terrestrial TV?
So that was the other thing I was thinking. I think so. I think they're going to release season one just like HBO releases and Netflix releases their shows on Blu-ray.
Right.
Like, you can subscribe or you can buy it on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Star Trek Discovery is formatted in a way that there's room for the commercial breaks there. Like, they pause, they fade out and fade in, and it feels like they have commercial breaks.
I'm so used to that from Netflix, I don't even think about it. That's interesting. Like, I'm watching Next Gen or something where they do that.
Right. But a Netflix show just goes on. It's a movie.
Yeah.
But Discovery, actually, I don't know if you notice it, but it actually does like the fade out. I don't know if it's a stylistic thing to make it feel like a Star Trek show, or if it's built in into the Act 1, Act 2, Act 3 structure for commercial breaks. But it feels like they could do commercial breaks.
Are all the episodes exactly the same length?
I don't know.
Down to the minute? Yeah. That'd be a tell.
Yeah. I mean, they would re-edit. They have no problem if they were going to do like a terrestrial broadcast, do a re-editing, or do a big sponsored buy, right? Put in a bad time slot and say, free from commercial breaks, this thing is sponsored by this company, Tide Cleaning for your Star Trek shirts.
Whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. Are you watching Star Trek Discovery, Zach?
I'm not. Again, it's that cheap side of me. It's the same thing with canceling HBO. Okay. I'm like, I'm actually waiting for it to come out in a set where I can get it on Amazon or some other service just to binge watch it, but I'm gleaning enough from friends and family that are into it that I know that it is my style of entertainment. Just I can't, there's nothing else on CBS that I care that much about.
Yeah.
So
who is it, Will? When Will was here, he said he was, his family was subscribed to CBS All Access before Star Trek aired because they were the right demographic for the CSI shows or the Big Bang Theory or whatever. Like, it is the full library of those shows. And there is, I'm sure there is a large part. It's a non-zero part of the population.
Because Will's there, whom, at least.
Yes.
Just the Ben in this room, maybe not as much.
No. Yeah.
It's
all
Trek.
Yeah, but maybe if you're not subscribed to CBS All Access, you can spend that money elsewhere. Maybe buying a Nintendo Switch and playing the new hottest game coming out this week. Also...
Also Friday.
This is crazy. My goodness.
Wait a minute.
I can't play any. I can't do any of this
Who
until Sunday.
Who scheduled the live show? I just want to know because, like, clearly the schedule is way off.
This is like movie studios competing for a movie release date. So we had booked in our live show date almost a year in advance. It's always like the Saturday before Halloween.
And honestly, there's no hard feelings if you're in the audience playing Mario on your Switch.
I'm going to be very jealous.
Or watching Stranger Things on your iPhone. It's
I'm
all good.
So jealous. Just find me. I'll save an empty seat. No spoilers.
That's right.
Mario Odyssey is coming out this Friday. I'm super excited.
I don't think I'm going to play it. I want to save it until Christmas. Is that crazy?
That is crazy. Why?
Because you don't get these that often, and it is a Christmas item.
You don't have the water cooler talk. You binge Zelda. You finished Zelda.
That's an impressive binge.
In like a week and a half.
Dude, I wasn't going to wait all year for Zelda, but...
But I mean, Mario is the antithesis of the Nintendo. Like, the fact that it's we've had to wait this long to get a real Mario.
And Mario games traditionally have been linear in terms of... World 1-1, World 1-2. It is perfect for the water cooler talk. How far along the game are you? Zelda, being more open ended, is not a water cooler game. There's no shame in stretching it out.
Yeah.
Here, come next week, we're gonna be Jeremy. Did you see that amazing thing in World 1-2? In the first 30 minutes of the game, of the game.
Maybe I video games. Christmas means video games to me because when I was a kid, it's what I used to get, and so. I want that feeling again.
Part of the nostalgia.
I want to then watch Nobody Give It to Me. So then
you want someone to gift it. You want to open the package.
I want to give somebody that.
Are you that kid in the N64 ad? that classic video? Oh my God.
It's his Red Ryder BB gun. Is,
exactly. Yeah. I don't know. That seems like a nice thing to do to me. But I don't need to play it right now. I can enjoy it. Hearing about from you, that's fine.
Okay,
you
wait for the reviews.
Yeah,
reviews do come out Thursday.
God,
and the fact that it's not a week before, is that telling?
That's a really good question. There is already there are two early reviews already out. Edge magazine has magazine has a 10 out of 10 review.
Okay,
for Mario, and the Japanese magazine Famitsu gave it a 39 out of 40. So it's up there. It's supposed to be as good as as Zelda, which one of the best games of all time at this point.
Yep.
So a launch console with two best games of all time potential contenders in 1 year.
That's all you need.
That makes that system and the Switch becoming readily available. You can buy one on Amazon right now. No problem.
Now that I think about it, I think part of it is that I'm not as excited to play this as I have been previous Mario games because of the previews that I've seen. I'm not really turned on by the real world New York City look that Mario goes into.
The new Donk City. When they announced this game, the big part of the trailer was Mario in this not exactly Grand Theft Auto style world, but
real world. Yeah.
It turns out that's not a big part of the game. That's only one aspect of it.
I saw that there were many aspects to it.
Yeah. The thing that worried me was the power of the Switch itself, because they showed this trailer for this Mario game. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for the Switch sound.
Yeah.
when they announced the hardware, it's mobile Android hardware. It's like it's a Tegra. It's a last gen NVIDIA Tegra chip. And the big fear for before Zelda came out and when they first showed this Mario Odyssey was that, were these going to be dumbed down experiences? Can you have a full open world GTA style game on this type of hardware? And Zelda proved, one, you can.
Day one.
And two, Mario Odyssey proves that you can do that GTA thing and also have other 90% of the game in the classic Mario aesthetic and pack a lot of content. I mean, they've had some success getting non-traditional developers, at least Nintendo developers, putting games on Switch. You're going to see Doom on Switch.
The new one.
The most recent one.
Yeah,
the one that came out last year
that's
on
impressive.
Switch. Yes, it'll be 30 FPS, but they say the experience is going to be almost exactly the same. And the new Wolfenstein game. I'm considering not playing it on PC. I'll most likely play it on PC.
Yeah.
But the appeal of it being portable and at the exact same game
there's something
pretty compelling.
Again, being portable, I mean, screen size. Come on. I mean, for a game like Wolfenstein or Doom, it's it has to be in your face. I mean, that is that intensity. If, the goblins are
and the keyboard mouse.
And the keyboard mouse.
I'm a keyboard mouse guy. Yeah. But the idea that you can get the full story experience.
Right.
Right. If you're putting on headphones, you get the full action and gameplay. The action and gameplay are the reason I'll play it on a 4K monitor with keyboard and mouse. But you can get all the cinematics, all the fidelity of that on something you can take
it's
on
impressive.
An airplane.
When you're hooked on a game, you take it however you can get it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So very excited. But now that we're back in technology, let's talk about tech news. All right, so we mentioned PrimeSense, which Microsoft acquired PrimeSense. Is that right? Is that the case?
I don't know if they actually acquired them. I think they were separate for at least a little while.
Okay, but that technology is in not only in the structure sensor, but also Microsoft Kinect.
The first one.
The first one, at least.
Yes.
Yes, and there was a new Kinect when the Xbox One came out, and we all knew it was going to be the case when Microsoft decided that it was not going to be a mandatory pack-in accessory, that once they made the Kinect optional for developers and optional for consumers, that it may not have a long life, and that is absolutely the case. So the Kinect is going to – they've officially stopped production on the Microsoft Kinect for Xbox One, the new one.
That's crazy.
Is that – Xbox One is how old now? 2 years old?
two, something like that.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years
old. It's an interesting thing because, you know, you look at sort of competing technologies. I mean, in some ways, all of our VR, whether it's Oculus or Vive or whatever it is, has some sort of motion tracking technology. It's almost like they're canning it before they've come up with their next thing. In some ways, I would love a Kinect tied into my Oculus so that I can have body and hand tracking
right.
without actually doing, you know.
I think it ended up being cost, right? The cost versus the
versus the market. Who's buying for it? And also who's developing for it? Because I think the excitement of, you know, I'm going to develop games for this very, you know, dedicated hardware that doesn't really have a analog on the PlayStation anymore. I mean, it used to be the
PSI.
The PSI, but that kind of lost luster once we got to, you know, PlayStation VR. So,
but the PSI became a part of PSVR. But like, not it became an accessory to be used.
It did as almost a hack, though, because that became the motion tracking device. They no longer track, you know, just your body. So
you used to play kung fu games where you'd swing around. It was almost Kinect-like.
Yeah,
and the Kinect had really great skeletal modeling.
Oh, really nice.
And it could do so many cool things. I think the problem is that because it wasn't a mandatory pack-in, the games that were supported really had to be Kinect-focused games.
They tried. They tried, you know, selling the bundles with the Kinect earlier, especially with the previous generation.
Right.
But just nobody wanted to play those games.
And they were also completely undercut with the PS4 launch that year.
Right.
Back in 2014, that's what it was. 3 years, wow. So it's really sad because a lot of that passive functionality, I think, is where, like, the cool stuff for the Kinect come, you know, the facial recognition. The things that they just can't explore anymore. Like, I don't need Kinect-centric games, but I would like that functionality of Kinect to make its way and to enhance games in some way.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting. You actually look at some of the technology that went into it. So, like, they did a lot of voice recognition, so you could do voice commands and stuff through the Kinect sensor. Like, that was part of it. They did all the motion tracking. I mean, there's a lot of pieces of that that are sort of cutting edge now, just in different, you know, for VR, for instance, or your Amazon Echo, or your sort of all these different, it's almost like they came in too early and they didn't have quite the exact target to, you know, to really sell it.
And they are also maybe misled by how successful the first Kinect was as an accessory because of the marketing hype. Again, the first Kinect maybe didn't have long legs, but initially that holiday launch, it was incredibly successful because it was something novel. It was something different, and they had enough games to support it, and it did really well as an optional accessory. So when the Xbox One came around, it made a lot of sense for them to upgrade that and put it in, but they didn't stick with it because maybe the market moved past them. But it also takes away that ability for them to think, what is Microsoft going to do with VR on the Xbox One, you know, with the Scorpio? They have said that VR is somewhere in the future. They think that, you know, their mixed reality design is going to be PC first right now. But if there's no Kinect, how do you get that type of VR tracking experience on Xbox? It would have to be something separate. You have to be some type of inside out, probably inside out tracking.
Well, clearly. I mean, that's what Microsoft is.
That's what they're banking on. So not outside in. You don't need a separate camera. They'll sell headsets. Whenever VR comes to Xbox, headsets with inside out, which honestly is an easier setup experience.
For setup, absolutely. Whether it gives you the same fidelity, that's really the question. And it comes down to developers again. I mean, I think it's how well do developers, you know, plan their interfaces so that, you know, can I see my hands and can I interact with things that are outside my field of view, or at least the camera field of view.
And I think if you're designing a VR experience for the living room, it may be different than the type of VR experience. You want VR experiences that are going to be cross-platform, right? Like, that's going to get the most market audience. But, like, PSVR experiences aren't exactly the same as the PC VR experiences.
Sure.
Because, one, you know there's going to be a couch. You know there's going to be a TV. You have ability for, you know, asymmetric experiences, people on the couch doing something. You know people are going to be facing forward. You know that most living rooms are set up to this type of configuration. You maximize that. You're not going to do a lot of 360 room scale walking around. It's mostly going to be in the kind of standing in, like, you know, your 4-foot by 4-foot area type of thing. So maybe that doesn't need
full tracking.
Of cameras and full tracking.
Yeah, I mean,
that can be good enough for living room.
It just depends what the expectation is.
Yep, absolutely. And if you have the TV and you do inside out tracking, you also have another reference point.
Yeah.
You know that there can be things pop on the TV, or you can calibrate to your TV as a tracker.
Sure.
As a marker.
The more interesting use for Kinect that I was, you know, was watching was the robotics stuff.
And oh, yeah.
So are there alternatives to Kinect that are just as easy to implement?
I mean, there's all sorts of things. I mean, basically, you know, all of your LiDAR, you know, scanners, and, you know, they're much more expensive. I mean, the thing with the Kinect was because it was a commodity item, it was commodity, you know, spatial location and distance measurement. And that's hard to come by. In fact, I mean, a lot of people use the off the shelf, and I don't know if they're actually getting rid of the
Windows one.
The Windows one as well. You're nodding yes.
I don't know.
But I would assume they would. But, yeah. That was like a really cool thing for $150. Like, you get, you know, something that you can do SLAM, or you can do, you know, scanning, or you can do all these different things.
There was a very mature development community surrounding that.
Absolutely. And anytime that you have, you know, sort of high tech that goes into a commodity product that you can then leverage into kind of the hobby world, that's huge. So doing the same thing with other, yes, there's lots of ways of doing the same thing. You know, there's the RealSense stuff that's still sort of floating around, and I think even Intel's coming out with some new hardware for that in the next couple months. Now that's all using just stereo cameras, and they've got some custom ASICs for doing depth mapping with that. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of sad that's no longer going to be as readily available. So I would imagine the, you know, aftermarket you know, supply of those is going to last the hobbyist a while, but we'll see. Yeah.
I don't want to apologize. PrimeSense wasn't Microsoft. It was Apple who bought PrimeSense. That's why I got confused.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Is that true? Because there was a rumor about that a few years ago, but then I thought maybe they acquired it at one of their competitors.
No, I mean, as of 2013, you know what? Maybe it's still a rumor or speculation. Yeah, maybe this new story.
I know there wasn't a PrimeSense sensor in the second Kinect. That was only in the first Kinect.
Got it.
So.
Speaking of other Xbox news, this week Xbox also finally enabled backward compatibility with the original Xbox. Is this something people were excited about? Like, how many Xbox One or Xbox One S owners still hold on to their old Xbox games?
I think it's that nostalgia thing. I mean, I think for some people, that was their Christmas morning, and they opened up their Xbox, you know, I can't say Xbox One, but their Xbox original.
This is the problem with console gaming, right?
Yeah. What?
Like, on PC, you wouldn't have this. PC, you have good old games, you have dude, Steam, like,
but that's just like, as much, that's more of a pain in the butt. Like,
that's
like,
not
good old, right? If you buy the classic stuff on good old games, it's just DOSBox. Like, it's DOSBox with the game in it, and you hope it runs right.
That's because there's a much longer history of PC games.
Yes.
But if we're talking about a game that came out in, like, the mid-thousands, or, like, early thousands, with the actual original Xbox, all of those PC games are going to run on your Windows PC.
Is that true?
Most of them are going to run on your Windows.
Probably.
If you get the original KOTOR, right? Knights of the Old Republic is going to run on your Windows PC.
Yeah.
Now KOTOR will run on your Xbox One.
along with Crimson Skies.
Along with Crimson Skies. So it's like a dozen games.
So what's the deal? If you already own these back in the day, like if you owned them digitally, do you just get them again? Or do you have to buy them again?
Oh, yeah. The license for...
Because that's one of the benefits of the digital download, right? Like, Microsoft knows I own it. They're going to give it to me again, right?
It's a really... They're in the store. You can buy them again for sure.
Well, that's
like $10.
That's not a surprise. $10?
$10.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
These aren't even $360 games.
Or more. And you can't even play them till... Well, I guess you can play them now. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know if they're in your account, if the Xbox One infrastructure or Xbox Live infrastructure...
Could you even buy them online? Did the Xbox One even have a digital download?
You mean the original Xbox?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think the Xbox One store.
Oh, well, then maybe they don't know you own them.
Yeah.
I can't, yeah. Wow.
Someone's holding on.
You have to find that disc.
That Crimson Skies. I mean, I wonder if eBay prices for these have jumped up to definitely not more than $10, but like from 99 cents to $2.
Oh, you're saying they actually run the actual disc? It's not a digital download?
Oh, no.
It's digital download now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Will they run the actual disc?
So you have to buy them? I don't like this.
Yeah. Can I get them all for like $30?
Well, you want a pack. You want the pack, and you want them to take off you can redeem your UPC code and then make the pack like a little bit cheaper?
You know what? These are great games. Prince of Persia, awesome game.
The original, the Xbox Prince of Persia, not the original like, PC.
No, the Sands of Time or whatever.
Yeah, that one was game changing for platformers, for 3D action platformers.
By the way, Apple did buy PrimeSense. You were right. You were right. Yeah.
It was rumored and then confirmed. That's what it was. Okay. So we were all right. Yep.
I never played Knights of the Old Republic. I'm that guy.
What?
I know. People think it's the best game ever.
We're going to spoil it.
I could. What? The game?
There are spoilers that you can have in the game.
I never got to a spoiler because I tried it like two or three times.
So you're not a fan of those BioWare RPGs?
I guess I'm not. It's different than Mass Effect, though. Because
Structurally, they're very similar.
The mechanics.
The combat is all dice rolls in Knights of the Old Republic.
Master are kind of dice rolls, dice rolling in Mass Effect 2.
Yeah, but don't they make you feel like you have more agency?
They totally illusion. It's like Fallout, right? You aim, but
you're looking for in life.
You aim and you press the button, and then they do a dice roll.
Just make me feel it.
Right, your weapon. They have to make the weapon better in some way. They can't make it, you know.
Yep. I just want joy. I want to hear what I want to feel.
Okay, Joe. Jeremy. Jay. You know, I've been using the Essential phone for, I guess it's like 3 weeks now since New York Comic Con. And we're going to do a review. I like it a lot. The price was a big problem for me. It was $700. But for anyone considering it, and I know the Pixel 2 is out now, but this is a nice bare bones phone with not a great camera system. The price is now $200 cheaper. It's been out for a month, and they've cut the price
just
by
what Apple
$200
did with the original iPhone.
Yeah,
and I think it's because they've had some issues with the camera system, and the reviews haven't been great. But it's kind of sad because it's a small company, and it's one of those things that showed that you didn't need to be a multi-billion-dollar company to release a really great smartphone. There's a lot of parts that you can get and suppliers you can talk to, and with a small design team, you can come with something that's great. But they didn't have the engineering for the software side, the camera side. They did try to do some novel things with their camera fusion. It actually, I don't know if Jeremy, you know, has a black and white camera and a color camera, and it fuses the images together to give you more detail, but that then takes the shutter speed from a millisecond to like 2 seconds.
Right.
So it's kind of unfortunate. It doesn't bode well that now it's $500, and anyone who bought an Essential phone before, they get credit back to buy accessories if you want to like get their 360
the full
camera.
$200?
Yeah, for accessories.
That's nice.
Because the idea is that it has magnetic ports in the back for a 360 camera.
Yeah.
But I feel bad. I feel bad for them because I want to see companies like this succeed.
Well, it's still not cheap. I mean, hopefully they're still making money.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that also blows my mind. Like, consumers, we think that phones, because we've been trained by Apple, trained by other high-end manufacturers, Samsung, you know, phones are $600. They're like $300 manufactured, right?
Well,
like,
sure, but everybody has to take their cut.
It's a big cut.
I mean, it is.
Yeah, the average selling price only goes higher for their margins go higher. When you listen to like the Apple earnings calls, like they care about what that margin is per device.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And that's why you see, you know, everybody carrying an iPhone in, you know, Target and Walmart and everywhere you go, because they do have that margin. And if they don't get the distribution and they don't get the visibility. And, you know, it's a whole ecosystem.
And a lot of that margin's in like things like RAM. It's like a storage, right? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, they're making
bucks for, you know, an extra 32 gigs of storage back then when they were selling 32 gig, 64 gig phones. That was ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what? But they've learned that lesson. People were willing to pay for that extra bit of room, and that is just pure gravy.
Did you know that Best Buy sells all their iPhones at like a markup over the MSRP?
Wait,
they just get away with it?
No.
Like I have no idea.
If you wanted to buy an iPhone 10, for example.
They price match.
No, don't price match. Not for iPhones.
Really?
Then they have Apple stores inside their Apple pop-ups, right? Or whatever they call them, right? But if you want to buy an iPhone 10, which like everyone knows, $1,000 the base model, it's actually $1,100 at Best Buy.
That's the fine print.
Actually, $1,100 if you want to get a Best Buy.
After tax.
Before tax.
That's crazy.
Before tax. They did it with iPhone 7. They do with the iPhone 8. It's just a supply and demand. They're like, we want an extra, because I bet they have to pay Apple close to whatever Apple's. They don't get
just dealing with the chaos of you know, early release and all of that.
You would think that just having a supply right, in the store would get them like the halo effect for accessories. Like even if they're making close
like a
to zero,
leader. Like right. you, yeah, you right. you would it's think like just getting
margin,
them in the door,
getting in the door on the day one. Hawking your self, your battery cases, your Bluetooth headphones, and making margin on that, it would be enough. Or warranty plans, right? I guess it's Apple Care still, so Apple still takes that part. But like, but they're like bold enough to try to make extra $100, extra 10% off the top, and Apple's okay with that too.
This is another Friday event.
This is it. I get no. It's next week.
What?
There's no
the
line.
The pre-order is this Friday.
Yeah, but you can be on a live show and do the pre-order. You're not going to be in line. I guess maybe you should be in line. So the 10 comes out November 3rd, which is next Friday, I want to say.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah. It's end of next week. Nothing exists right now before the live show. But on the 27th, people are going to be able to pre-order. And hope they get one. So if you're in the market for iPhone 10, apparently the best way to pre-order is with the app.
That's been the case since the app.
So the app will get you the website.
The
will
website
be
crashes.
Clogged. Yeah. All the carrier sites are gonna be terrible.
Here's the weird thing: they have this iPhone upgrade program that they announced years ago.
Yep.
At least 1 year ago, if not two.
Yep. Yep. And it's a subscription plan for your phone.
It's basically a 0% financing, you know, thing where they allow you to pay for your phone monthly over the course of 2 years, and after a year, they allow you to trade up to the newest phone, but you have to trade in your old phone.
Right.
They've allowed those people who are already in the program to pre-qualify for the upgrade. But you can't pre-qualify if you're not a member, which is interesting. You certainly could. They could run the credit check. Because the whole concern is, will you be able to check out fast enough at midnight on Thursday night?
Sure.
And so people would like to pre-qualify for this program, but you can't. So the only way, I don't know why you'd enter this program now unless you're willing to like wait months for your phone.
So even if you're on the program,
If you're on the program, you're good.
You're good, but you're good, but you may not get it next week.
Well, no, because you can pre-qualify this week. If you're in the program, you can pre-qualify.
But that doesn't put your spot in line.
You don't know. You're like everyone else.
You still need.
You can check out quickly.
Your two steps,
which is weeks, one click worth of getting your phone.
Could be. Yeah.
Well, with only 20 million or whatever it is, production
45,000.
No, that was the first shipment. It's like 3 million, something like that.
We don't know what the numbers are. Some analysts think that they won't be easy to get until April of next year.
April
of next year.
Almost like new phone territory.
Yeah. And which is, I'm shocked that Tim Cook and their head of retail, Angela Earhart, they did an interview with BuzzFeed, and like they were frank about the fact that they're going to have some in stores on November 3rd. But get there early, they say with a smile. They want lines.
Yeah.
They want lines of disappointed people. That's going to be... is that going to raise their stock price or lower their stock price?
Dude.
Like, doesn't that say that's they have supply problems?
They do have supply problems.
More than they have good demand problems?
They do. They do.
Right? The happy medium would be a ton of people waiting in line outside, but everyone's satisfied. Right,
dude. You're not even mentioning the worst case scenario, which is what if the phone is a problem?
I was gonna say if it has some bug or it's a flop.
Like, yeah, what if people actually find a way around Face ID, or what if it doesn't work right?
No reviews out yet.
Exactly.
They have embargo on those reviews as well.
What if the screens aren't working right? Like, this is all new OLED for Apple. There's a lot of new territory here, and like they can only afford to charge those margins you were talking about if they have a killer product.
Yeah.
Right. And there's even a rumor now, which Apple has come out against, that in order to help with the supply, they are weakening the Face ID sensor, like going with a cheaper sensor or taking like...
Time will tell.
I don't think they would do that. I don't think...
You have to almost treat this as a first release product. Like, this is...
A first gen
or first something. Because it is... It's such a departure. And it's the first time they've done two major, you know, releases in 1 year. Like, this is new territory.
It's completely new. In terms of, like, the reviews of the iPhone 8 were good. Like, I think people who read
they're
them said
fine.
They're fine.
You own one.
I have one.
But it's fine, and I'm sure it's a perfectly good phone, and it's more expensive than the 7 was last year. They raised it by like $50 or something.
Yeah.
What's the big new feature? It is just charging. Wireless.
It's faster.
It's faster. That's charging
in the
back.
It's got a new processor. That's what it boils down to.
Well, let's rephrase that. It doesn't have a new processor. It runs the new software
right
just as fast as your phone last year ran last year's new software.
Yes.
So it's better compatible with the newest version of iOS.
Right.
But yes, the 10 is something completely different. And I have no idea how the naming scheme is going to work going forward. Do you have any bets?
You mean like, will they go to 11?
Yeah, they can go to 11. Or are they going to have
10.1?
Yeah. I think they're going to save the going to 11 joke. Because that is something Apple will, that's a dad joke Apple will make. Going to 11. That will be 10 years from now. That will be years from now. Yeah. I think they're going to go 10.1, 10.2.
Really?
You don't think so?
I don't know.
They're going to start naming them after mountains?
I could totally see them just calling it iPhone from now on and coming up with.
So there will be no iPhone 9 at all?
That's confusing.
I think it's going to be a Yosemite phone or they'll come up with some other landmark to, islands or
something. So what does the 8 become next year? Like what will follow up?
I think
the
it's 8? Just going to fade out. I think they're going to go to a new platform. I think it's almost like a.
You think the 10 will be. The reason I don't think so is if you look at the lineup now, they need something on the entry level on the low end. They still sell the 5SE.
Yeah.
They still sell a form factor that that apps have to support.
It's really the perfect form factor. That's what I had before my 8 and or not an SE, but yeah, it's actually for kids, that's what my daughter has. She's 12. That's her phone.
How does new iOS run on SE?
It's clunky.
I bet app developers or even internally at Apple, they all must have the SE
as their baseline.
Or no, I guess the 6 because they still sell the 6. Right? The 6S. No. What is it? No. I think it's still 6S, 7, 8. Yeah, 6S yeah, must be right. Their baseline, like the worst
still
performer.
Still must be compatible.
That's what I'm running. I would hardly call it compatible.
You'd hardly call it fine performance?
It's not a phone anybody would be proud to show off. You'd never show the way that iOS 11 and performs on it on
yet
stage.
And it was fine last year, a year and a half ago with
10.
With 10.
It was perfectly fine.
And yet, new OS, to get that new command center, you got to make your phone a little slower.
All those that fancy CPU animations. To get that animations, exactly.
Do you hear about the people are complaining about the marketing for the Apple 10, the iPhone 10, how their big ads are, it's all screen.
Mm.
That's their tagline.
It. Yeah.
It's all screen, and yet that they show right next to
black
that
bar.
Is the black bar that shows it's not. They can't win. They can't win because there's no... There is. What's the marketing?
Well, the weird thing is they're not first to market with that either. Like, I'm looking at a phone here that's all screen,
and then this one has a notch and has a chin.
But it's pretty great.
It's chin
in terms of how much screen it is. It's pretty screeny.
Yes,
it's pretty screeny.
So, what would you define it? What would you call something like this? It's edge to edge.
Yeah,
you can't say it's edge to edge
because there's still a chin.
Samsung has the Edge is a brand for Samsung, right? The Samsung Galaxy Edge. So
this is why we're not in marketing,
right? they've cut no corners. No, wait, they've cut all the corners.
Oh, man.
The phone does nothing but cut corners.
that's a good tagline.
we've cut all the corners on our phone. Only curves. Curves, not corners.
It's just a sphere pretty soon.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway. We're gonna follow the iPhone 10 launch with great interest and curiosity.
Now, are you gonna get an iPhone 10?
It's not out of the question. We'll see. We'll see what it looks like at 12 a.m. on the 27th. If it's a wait till April, no way. Not gonna put money down. Not gonna commit something to wait till April.
I've been seriously thinking about trying to downgrade to iOS 10
and just see what still works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how possible that is.
I think it's totally possible.
I read something about it's not signed anymore, and so the trick might be getting around that.
Do illegal things.
I don't want to bother with jailbreaking it. So I don't know. We'll see.
The problem I have with the 10, it is super new and shiny, and there is a reasonable chance I will want one and maybe even get one. Is you can see all the ways as a first gen product it can be improved. That they can put some new feature
already
easy, right? And I'm not even talking about reducing the notch. I completely understand what they're talking about, but all the ways in terms of like putting back Touch ID, putting it in the back somewhere, right? There are all the rumors about them not finding a fingerprint sensor, or improving the software, or improving the screen. Like the thing I wanted that it's not there is I wanted a 120 hertz screen. Like features that you already see on their other product lines, right? The iPad Pro has that 120 hertz screen that people say once you look at it,
amazing.
Once you use it, right? Now once you scroll with that, you can't go back to an older iPad. And yes, it costs a lot of money, but this one also costs a lot of money. And I know there are battery life considerations here, But they're supposed to be, they own the hardware, they own the software. I would love to see that.
Yeah, me too.
On a phone, on an iPhone.
Is that going to make you buy 10.1?
the phone next year?
The phone next year, or yeah, whatever it then, is.
I mean, that's Apple's strategy all
Maybe
along,
Maybe they
right?
named it 10 because they actually need a full year to get it in stock. So 8 can just catch up next year. They can launch the 9, and they'll finally have the 10 available, like for anybody.
This is, boggles my mind. Marketing classes must be talking about this.
This might go down as, yeah, as you know, history in bad marketing. It just seems weird. They have
one of the most recognizable brands on the planet. Names on the planet, mm-hmm, right? So much that it influenced the naming scheme for most of their other product lines, product categories. And yet they're creating confusion when
but this needed to be the case. But they do. I mean, that's why they went to iPad. It wasn't, you know, there was...
iPad Pro. It went iPad, yeah, iPad Pro.
So but there was no longer a numbering scheme. That's
iPhone,
what I said.
iPhone Pro. Like, those are two... What is actually happening here is they're price segmenting their product line, right? Yeah. It's not linear. It's two things. You want the entry level, or you want the high end. You want the one that everyone... It's good. They all have similar features, but you want the one that everyone can get, or you want the one that only the fancy people get. Yeah. Then you can call it, you know, iPhone Pro.
All right, I think we've
exhausted
this one
we
to
have,
death.
We have. How about a simpler naming scheme? How about the Sony Alpha A7R3 with 1-3 Roman numeral and not the number 3?
Wait, what does this mean? This is a new camera?
New camera. New. It's
the whole A7 line or just the R?
It's the... The first in the it's just the R.
Okay.
So, but it's a continuation of the A7 line. Yeah. So, the high end camera, if you follow Sony cameras, and they've been doing really well, they perform really well. Is the A9 was earlier this year, very expensive, but it's basically their competitor to the Canon, like the 1D series, like sports photography, incredible frame rates. The A7 series was very popular. It's basically their equivalent to the 5D line, the prosumer, high end prosumer, full frame camera. And the third version, the A7 R3, is finally announced. People were waiting for this for a long time. I think because of some of the flooding or earthquakes in Southeast Asia, some of their sensor manufacturing facilities had been put on hold. And so this was delayed, this announcement. But from all reports, based on the specs, this is a worthy successor to the A7 R2.
Cool. So the A7 II brought a... motion stabilization.
Yes, it still has that.
Okay, so what does the 3 bring?
The 3, it's 40.
One like more digit.
I believe it's 40, it's more megapixels and higher frame rate, which are like okay, the big things. Like stabilization, I don't think it's like a paradigm shift in terms of the stabilization stuff, but it's 42 megapixel at 10 frames per second with full autofocus.
Oh, 10 frames of photos.
10 frames per second for photos.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then how long? So that's
the question.
Yeah, so it's the buffering size.
Yes, the buffering size plus the memory card read, right, like, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Depends what you're shooting. Like,
yes.
Your
right.
settings.
Right. If you're in RAW.
But so this is 10 frames of RAW.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about, you know, 50 megs per image or more. You're needing one of those 140 megabytes per second memory cards.
Right.
Right. And of course, it'll do. And it has dual memory card function, so it may do right. like a swap back and forth. Back and forth. So what is it? 28 raw photos in 2.8 seconds. So it's 10 frames per second for 2.8 seconds.
Okay.
But if you're doing sports photography or if you're doing any type of action photography,
you only need 2 seconds worth.
Is great. I mean, we want to get
impressive.
That point though that they're shooting like. 24 is that magic number, isn't it? Right.
Well,
24 FPS raw, continuous
at 40 megapixels.
At 40 megapixels, let's say reduced down to like even
megapixels.
You don't need 40 megapixels there
for video
for continuous shooting.
Yeah, I mean then it's a cinema camera.
Then that's a cinema camera. Then that's basically like motion JPEG except motion raw.
Yeah, it's your RED camera. I mean this is the spec for your, you know.
That's what I want eventually. We're not quite there yet, but it's like when people I think for cameras over the past 10 years, people are definitely more educated about sensors, right? Like 10 years ago, when point and shoots were still king, no one, like consumers, professionals knew, but consumers didn't care about sensor size. Now we hear about sensor size. We hear about like not only bigger sensors, but quality of sensors. We hear about those in Apple keynotes, in Samsung keynotes. And it's no surprise that people understand bigger sensor, more light, better depth of field, better. But a lot of people don't think about, even on the smartphone side, the processing.
Right? Sure.
And I think Apple's starting to push on that marketing, talking about a lot of that post-processing work.
The software features, yeah.
That happens in real time.
Well, because we're getting to the point now, I mean, it used to be a number, and it's like, oh, well, my one megapixel camera is better than my, you know, half megapixel camera.
How do you quantify it, right? So before, 30 megapixel better than 10 megapixel, and then you talk about, okay, one-inch sensor better than, you know, three-quarter-inch small
sensor.
Again,
this is just all marketing anyways, because it's also how you use those megapixels. I mean, that's actually the biggest thing. I mean, you look at the cameras that are on, you know, the Mars rovers, and they're these tiny little cameras, but they're producing these amazing images because they're doing scans, or they're doing post-processing, or they're doing all of these different things. Right. And, yeah, that the magic is, we're getting to the point now where there's diminishing returns in hardware. It's all about the software. It's all about the sort of user.
Tracks. Yeah. Like, you get, like, diminishing returns physically, because you can't put large, like APS-C, you went to full frame. You're not going to put much larger than a full frame sensor. No one's designing. I mean, yes, there are what do you call them? Larger than full frame, medium format digital cameras out there. But that's not going to hit consumers because lenses are going to be different. Right? Yeah. You need the whole ecosystem changes. What's that? With creaking.
What's that? In the office.
But on the software side, on the computational side, whole separate track. Faster processors, silicon gets better.
Storage.
They still haven't tapped into Moore's Law storage, right? All of these things move in parallel. And then how much of that you see in real time, too.
Right.
Right? Because if they're doing post-processing, and a lot of cameras, like people don't even think about how much processing is happening in real time to show you what's on the viewfinder.
Right.
Because you want to give the viewfinder image, like if you're saving JPEGs on your cell phone, there's processing happening. There's a DSP happening.
At some point, we're just going to be running Lightroom on our camera. Like, I mean, that's really what it's coming down to. I mean, we're getting enough compute power in the size. I mean,
in real time.
In real time.
Right. In the live view.
Exactly.
Right. Not just for a saved image, but in a 30 FPS or, you know, and then you want that to increase, right? You want the viewfinder to run at 90 FPS because you want it super smooth.
Well, and I want a higher resolution viewfinder.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Camera stuff is fascinating. I love this stuff. Anyway, I'm A7R3.
$3,000, right?
$3,200 for body only, and it's same price as the A7R II when that first came out. So it really is in the high-end prosumer market. If I didn't buy the 5D last year, this is the one I would probably go for. Yeah. Amazon. There was another Amazon story we were going to talk about.
There was?
Yeah. Oh, you know, speaking of how technology has changed over the past 10 years, you know, camera technology.
Too late for a segue.
No, I'm going to force it in.
Oh, man.
The Kindle's 10 years old.
Ah, happy birthday.
Do any of you still own an actual physical Kindle?
My daughter does. She uses it on a daily basis.
Does she have a tablet as well, or is the Kindle her tablet?
Kindle's kind of her tablet, yeah.
And you're not talking about Kindle Fire. You're talking about, like, the actual
e-book. Yeah, I think it's a black and white.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. The battery lasts forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Because when we talk about, like, the world change when, you know, iPhone came out and smartphones were changed, Kindle's kind of changed the world too, changed the publishing industry. But also in that 10-year time, we saw the whole cycle. Like, they're a commodity product, super cheap. It used to be like, let's wait till the Kindle's $100. That's going to be a magic mark. And now you don't even think about, like, no one cares about the new Kindle releases, the new hardware releases.
Yeah,
they're going to happen
because it's better.
But it's such a commodity product, which is like the goal.
Right, it's Amazon. It replaces a book.
It absolutely. You don't even think about it replacing, like, buying. I mean, people love holding physical books, but the ebook is a completely normal way to read a book, and the Kindle itself changed the publishing industry so much that once tablets and phones became ubiquitous and got better, it became obsolete. Like, there's still a purpose for it, but people who have phones can read ebooks on their phones.
My wife does, and it surprises me, but she reads entire books on her phone.
People it seems have iPads. I mean, if you have a XL phone, maybe. But like, I mean, if you've got,
I used to read on the iPhone 5 the full book.
Oh, that would hurt.
Yeah,
like
because it's a bright screen. The nice thing about the Kindles was it was a
soft on your eyes. I mean, and then it's also just the clarity. I mean, just the resolution,
which has gotten better.
Yeah,
over time. Yeah, I mean, they specifically did not design those to be high refresh rate play animations.
The technology doesn't let you do that. Like, you have to erase the screen before you draw the next picture. So
it's like a fast etch a sketch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not EA, it's but like there are some like type LCD similar technologies that don't have the backlight that can do the animations.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have no interest in buying a Kindle.
No, not anymore.
Right. Like, even the Kindle brand, Amazon is taken all the goodwill and kind of put it into their tablets.
Tablet. Yeah.
It's their Kindle Fire.
Yeah.
Right. And those are commodity products too. Super cheap and great for kids.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, salute to the Kindle, because that weird form factor, white framed ebook with a keyboard on the bottom and all those weird features.
Like, with no off button for a little while.
Right, right. That lasts forever and with whisper sync, like audio dictation, like all those weird experiments at all made the publishing industry the way it is. And I think like audiobooks would not be the way audiobooks are without the Kindle and
do you think it changed audiobooks?
I think that whisper sync, hearing the book with the Kindle, it trained people to think of books as more than just one type of interface. And audiobooks, I think, obviously benefited from bandwidth. Right, bandwidth in the storefront.
Absolutely.
And the Audible, the system of subscription-based system.
Yep.
Because those are very expensive to produce, but the cost being $15 a month for a book as opposed to $30, $40 a book,
right,
as they previously were. Or CDs, right? Buying the CDs. Did you guys ever do that?
Oh, I remember getting the big stacks of cassette tapes. I probably had the first release of Lord of the Rings on cassette.
How many cassettes was that?
Oh, it was this box. I remember it actually was floating around in my trunk for years.
Not a bridge.
Yeah, not a bridge.
Like, a bridge making the most sense for audio.
Not this one. This was mini car trips of long drives that I listened to Lord of the Rings.
I definitely grew up with because you had to rewind.
That's
That's a nightmare.
What do you mean you had to rewind? If you finished it, both sides, you're back at the beginning.
Oh, okay, so it's two sides. You're right. Okay, so you could do two sides.
That's right.
I completely forgot that tapes. I was thinking
VHS. You're thinking VHS.
VHS has to rewind. CDs, you didn't have to rewind.
Oh, that's
CDs.
Good.
But there were multiple binders.
Oh yeah.
Of CDs for a book, God, those are weird collector's items, artifacts of history.
I love those.
Now it's just a file.
I love those.
You love swapping it, swapping the CD, playing the CD, and what was the book you remember listening to on CD?
I remember listening to Stephen King's The Mist on tape. Like, it was really trippy because it had this, they did a full performance of it with this binaural sound. So they had all this stuff happening around
you. In your car, you could hear?
I headphoned it.
Oh, headphones.
Yeah.
Wow. Actually, I just realized, because we go to the library and my daughter gets Harry Potter CD, the books on tape on CD.
Right.
So we actually have them in our car right now. This moment. So
a good way to for library systems.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Though you actually can also do digital download.
Right
now, libraries are starting to do that.
Yes, so. And I think it's like this.
Get like 20.
It's not a life hack, but like people should get their library cards in their local library.
Oh, it's amazing.
You access to so many things. People just don't do it.
Yeah, tool library, tool lending. I mean, all kinds of good stuff at library.
VR.
Really?
Yeah, there's VR headsets in many libraries.
3D printing.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Go back to your libraries.
Do a trip to the library.
So if you purchase one of these new Amazon Kindle or an Amazon Kindle today, which you still can.
Yes.
And you
are
home.
Yes.
What would happen?
My delivery guy just throws it over the gate. It's a high gate too, I'm really impressed.
That's a good setup actually, because
no, it's not a good setup.
It's not good for your package, but you get your package and it's probably not going to be stolen.
You social engineer it, right? You leave the door half open.
Oh yeah.
And then only the UPS or the FedEx or the Amazon person knows that they can pull it, and then the unspoken contract is they close the gate fully.
Dude, wow. I leave instructions for that.
The instructions tell the hoodlums that, you're expecting a package. They know you're a target that day.
Yeah.
And two, they read the instructions, and they know how to get in just as well.
Well, there's a new method.
Okay, tell me about this new method.
Amazon Key.
Sounds good.
It doesn't
It's a service. Okay.
So what happens is, if you own an Amazon branded security camera, cloud connected security camera, it's inside your house, and you own one of the smart locks that is Wi-Fi enabled.
So these are products they don't make the smart lock.
They don't, but they do make the camera.
They make the camera. So this is like their Nest camera.
Yeah. So if you have that home, I don't know how many of those homes there are, but if you have that home, you can sign up for a service so that when your Kindle arrives and it's delivered by Amazon, not presumably UPS or FedEx.
But, I mean, is it ever Amazon?
It is for me.
Oh, really?
When they arrive, they can swipe a little tool on their phone and they can unlock your front door, walk into your house, and leave the package and leave, presumably locking it behind them. Now, I'm not sure how I feel about this. Because number one, I'm obsessive about getting my packages. I know when they're coming, and I want to receive them. And if I'm not home, I legitimately get stressed out about it because I like my stuff. So I like that I can get packages. The problem is my experience with Amazon delivery people has not been the best. They are not the most professional delivery dudes.
I didn't realize this was actual Amazon. I thought it was like my UPS guy was also.
So would you trust UPS?
My UPS guy, yes. He's awesome. I love my UPS guy. I treat him so well.
He has my garage code.
Oh, wow.
So I absolutely would trust
them. So someone you build a relationship with because it's on the route.
I invited him in to play pinball.
Oh, okay. But this is so.
When you want your packages, you treat your delivery guys well.
So this is Amazon taking over delivery. So like, if you're subscribed to a service and a package, they won't let UPS deliver that package. It has to be through their courier service.
Always a crapshoot. You never know who's going to deliver.
So then how does the key work if it's on the UPS truck?
I don't think it does. I think it's only if it's Amazon delivering.
So it's a weird, inconsistent service.
So you don't. There's no guarantee for delivery then.
Exactly. That's a good point.
And you're still letting people. I mean, are you opting into only Amazon couriers, or is it a checkout option? I need this package. I know I'm not going to be home.
Yeah.
Right. It's my iPhone 10.
Ensure that it's Amazon Courier.
Certainly Prime Now would be Amazon Courier.
Right.
Oh, for Prime Now.
But Prime Now, it's even worse because Prime Now, a lot of those are just contractors, not full-time employees. They're like Uber or Lyft.
That's what I'm saying, man. Lyft type. All their delivery people are like that.
Right. I'm not the biggest fan of this either.
And you get people following them who, you know, not only are they going to leave a package, they're actually going to open your door. People tail FedEx, absolutely.
And steal packages based on that?
Dude, you don't know about this?
This is a major
problem.
What?
Yeah, people follow the trucks and then they, you know, hop out and they
like
grab
around
the package.
Christmas time and anytime there's a lot of presents.
That's fucked up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we need more of these security cameras. I'm just not sure they should be letting people in.
Do you think this is a ploy to sell more Amazon shows? Because you use the show with a security camera so you're at the office, you have a show, and then once the camera turns on, it pops up on your display.
I think we're just going to start designing our homes differently soon. So there's going to be better package delivery because we're getting so many more.
Yes.
You know, the whole idea of a mailbox,
exactly.
It needs to be a mail locker or a something.
Yes, or like the area in between your front gate and your door, something.
Something that's secure.
Like yours.
Yeah.
Right. Or something on the ground, right? It's the bomb shelter.
It might also be the drone landing pad. Who knows? Like, I mean, all of these things. Like, we are shifting to a delivered economy.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe the infrastructure has to change.
That's interesting.
Or you can sacrifice the little bit of convenience of having it in your house and in your door, and make use of the lockers that are like right around the corner.
The Amazon locker.
If you're
lockers.
In an urban,
yes, but I think it's less of a problem these are only problems in urban areas where there's tons of doors.
No, I think it's actually some of the like especially the security problems are actually in the more suburban and rural areas because there's big distances. So when you see that UPS truck driving down the road, you know
there's a target.
Yeah, absolutely.
Waiting. Wow. So what is this? A $250 bundle that includes the lock, the camera and installation, right? We got to do more because this was just announced this morning. So the in-home delivery is an option every time you order from Amazon. It's exactly as we thought it would be. It would be a menu option and no additional charge. And the in-home delivery only available on specific items, so 10 million items. Again, makes some sense because it can't be something too big and bulky.
It's going to freak some families out,
and
man.
It's only available in about 37 cities right now. Who will be the one to test Amazon Key?
I vote Jeremy.
If you are home, or if somebody's home, they didn't know the package was coming.
Yeah,
it's gonna scare the hell out of them.
I think we should.
Well, that's why the camera system, right? That's why if you're home and you have the Echo Show at home,
yeah,
like now you have zero interaction with your delivery person. You're at home making food in the kitchen. Your Amazon Show pops up with the camera. Oh, my back door's open. Okay, they dropped the package. Thank you. And then they close the door, and that's it.
I think we should go in and get
no need to run to the front door.
That's the commercial. What you don't see in the commercial is the time they forget to lock it behind them.
and the burglars coming after it.
Yeah. Or the thank you, left the package, and then the Amazon person is standing right behind them with a knife. Right? It's the horror film.
Exactly. They,
the delivery came. The delivery came from within the house.
I think we should chip in and get Amazon home delivery for Mario Odyssey for Jeremy so he can get it as a gift.
Yep.
And the delivery guy will hand it to him and he'll be able to experience the whole thing.
We're joking about this, but this actually is a perfect surface for the office, for our office here. Because we have a front door that would work and we have a lot of deliveries but we like our delivery people. Mm-hmm. We like saying hi to our UPS driver and our USPS delivery person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, another event, next week is BlizzCon. So many events going on. We have our live show, Bay Area Science Festival. There's also, for people last week in Las Vegas, Adobe Max. Adobe Max annual. I've never been. I've always been curious about it. But people use Adobe's software suite always kind of like get a little nervous around Adobe Max because...
What are they going to change? How are they going to make my life?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. What incompatibilities may they announce?
And what's in the cloud now?
And last week we talked about a Lightroom change. So now it's
no longer
classic.
Buy Lightroom.
And you can't buy it as a separate package. And Lightroom as a service now, which, not that great. But they also unveil some prototype features. I think this is probably the most exciting part of Adobe Max when they, some experiments.
It's kind of sci-fi.
Last year they did the audio editing, right?
Where you can put somebody else's voice on somebody else's video.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And replace words and make audio editing perfectly seamless. It's still not out yet. But this year they announced a new a video editing tool or feature. And Zach, you're reading up on this. What's big about Sidewinder?
So Sidewinder. It's they kind of just say it's a little sort of pet project or something they're trying out. They don't make any claims that it'll make it into any product. But there's kind of this proliferation of 3D cameras and stereo cameras that people are capturing. Stereo VR. But it has kind of a flat feel to it. If you've ever looked at VR, that's just the video. It's sort of like just projected on a round sphere around you, and it doesn't have. You can't move your head. You basically have 3 degrees of freedom. You can tilt your head, but if you slide it side to side, it just kind of loses. It breaks the whole.
Yeah, the world goes with you.
The world goes with you. So the process or service that this project is demonstrating is basically taking stereo video and projecting it, we're actually creating a depth map first.
That's what I'm talking about, man. That's what I want.
So this is a depth map with just
two cameras. 2D.
Oh, okay. So
they use two cameras. This is stereo captured. At least that was the demo. So okay. they do correlation between the two frames to find out what pixels have moved how far, so they can actually get a depth map. Now that's pretty much off the shelf.
Right.
But then they project that video onto that depth map and do some. There's definitely some secret sauce in the back that sort of stretches the video just right. Now it did look a little clunky in their demo where they sort of had the edges where there wasn't data that was recorded. So like if you move far enough, you actually don't see certain parts of the image. So they kind of just stretch the video around it. But the fact that you get some lateral translation as you move your head in the VR image is actually really, really powerful.
I've always said I don't need much.
It doesn't take much.
I just want to move this much.
And for seated situations, that would make it so much more real. And they showed a couple different demos. One was a Christmas tree. And again, if you move very far, it kind of breaks. Mm-hmm. But if you really only keep it a couple inches, I feel like that would just add so much to VR video.
And the point is that this can be mapped on 360. When you think of depth maps, it's
Well, anything that's stereo, it has to. You still have to have stereo, so you'd have to have stereo 360. Right.
But it would still work in 360 if it was a stereo 360 setup.
If it's stereo 360 setup, yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. It's a neat thing. I mean, from the outlook, you kind of go, oh, okay, that just looks like more. But again, you're not experiencing it, just like all VR things.
The comfort. It's about just like that, just tilting. But you're gonna want more.
Yeah.
Once you have that, you're gonna want to reach out. You're gonna want to walk. Then you realize you can't do that either.
Yeah. I mean, that is the limit of video. But
yeah.
You know, but you could design it. Again, we're still dealing with, you know, certain types of cameras that have certain type of spatial distance. You know, I mean, people are coming out with bigger and better, you know, camera rigs for capturing more and more data.
I completely understand. And if you combine that with like a street view style, jump from node to node, then you're really moving around the world.
If you had Myst, the original Myst game in, you know, this sort of, you know, video, that's pretty compelling. I could definitely see some good stuff there.
This is more than a few inches of lateral movement,
too. Oh, well, they are definitely moving, but I think they're actually moving too far. I wish they would have
That they're showing the extremity. I think I like seeing the limits.
Well, you like to see where it fails.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I think from just the casual, you know, viewer, they're like, well, why does it do this weird thing? In fact, I actually saw some comments on some of the posts. They're like, well, that looks like junk because look at what it does. And it's like, no. It looks great for 6 inches. And that's really what you need.
Filthy casuals. Right.
Yeah.
Well, you guys remember Minority Report? And when Tom Cruise was viewing that old, like, Hall of projected video of his like family.
Plainer.
That's exactly the thing.
Yeah.
Like it was a 2D video superimposed over some type of depth map. And of course they're using fancy science fiction hologram systems. But that's exactly like the idea that you could hopefully take old stereo video, whether it's 360 or stereo video, right? Like library content stereo video and map it over a depth map.
Yeah,
using the
and actually get
would
now,
create more immersive viewing experiences.
Now that stuff.
They also talked about some of these other technologies, and I actually didn't put that in the notes, but I thought some of the other ones were kind of fascinating. That I think they could kind of merge with this. There's doing sort of the contents aware. They've always had I shouldn't say always, but it's been like 5 years. They've had context aware fill
for images. Right.
So they're starting to play with that in video
because
of the processing. But now you could imagine doing context aware fill in the VR areas that don't actually have the content visible.
Oh,
so you could actually start pulling that all together.
You're combining the projecting two stereo image on a depth map, and then on the sides where you have the gaps, the gray area,
fill
content
that in
with color.
Fill that with actually, you know, it's like, oh, I can identify that as a chair. I know what chairs look like because I've got this massive, you know, database of chair data.
But that doesn't even need to be real time then, because we're talking about
Video. It doesn't have to be on. Well, this is pre-processed. Mm. So this you could go through and you could actually process all your video. Again, it's capturing those real events. The hard part is the capture. Like I can spend all day long processing it, and I can use my deep learning, you know, my neural nets to go through and say, oh, okay, well, there's a half of a chair missing. If I know what a chair looks like, I can just substitute in a the side view of a chair.
You think about how the content aware would work. It'd have to be specifically designed for filling the blanks of 3D spaces.
3D, yeah, of course.
Because it wouldn't be, if you think of it as a texture map.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just, you can't content-aware fill a texture map and have it look good in 3D.
Well, but that's, in some ways, that's what they're doing. They are just doing texture maps. That's what this
is. Right, they're texture map. They're turning a stereo image into a texture map. But you can't throw that texture map in Photoshop. If I threw a texture map in Photoshop and had some blank area and said content-aware fill, it wouldn't work. Logically work.
Yeah, there's still some work to do is the bottom line.
Right,
but
I think that's
where we're headed. We're headed to the point where we can capture 90% of a room with a standard, a 3D type camera, 3D rig.
Yeah.
It's impossible to get all the data in all the room because of occlusion, of all these other problems.
Right.
But if we have enough smarts to fill that in.
Yeah, it's good enough.
That's good enough, or it could be.
For it to be convincing. And then, of course, we all want it in real time.
Of course.
Well, live streaming, right?
Well, we didn't have the dinosaur DNA. We just used frogs.
Content-aware genetics.
Nice.
Yeah, they were way ahead of the curve.
Good Jurassic Park pull.
Oh. You know, something stretching, warping the world. One last story. Found this kind of interesting. A low-tech way to warp the world is just with the illusions. And apparently, some places around the world, including Iceland, have started painting crosswalks and using optical illusions, perspective illusions, anamorphic illusions, I guess these are what they are, to make the crosswalks and other objects look like they're floating on top of the road. And this is the idea is to give distracted drivers
to distract them more.
Yeah, that's the problem, right?
You think it would distract normal drivers? more than it would take distracted drivers out of distraction, like the subconscious brain, because it only works in like the anamorphic style illusions only work with small viewing area.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, what you want. So when I go up to a crosswalk that is hard to see, you know, especially these days, they're now augmenting them with lights and they're sort of, you know, they're making them really visible.
Yeah.
I don't know that you're going to see this from any further away than, you know, sort of 20 feet. And at that point, you're already going too fast. You're going to run somebody over, or, you know, it's a funny thing. Like, it almost seems like it's just a distraction almost at the wrong time. Like, I don't want to distract them. It's too late.
Mm.
But it's cool. It looks cool.
Yeah.
It brings attention to the traffic problem.
Really, it is one of those things that you, the idea may sound great on paper,
yeah,
but unless you put it into action, there's so many of these.
I think it's more of an art project.
Yeah.
It definitely is an art project. I want to see it pop up in certain parts of the states. I want to see what the implications are and how people respond.
Do these perspective paintings even look right in stereo? Because they look great as a photo.
Right. That's always the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, again, only the limited field view. Like, a crosswalk is a wide area. If it's only in the middle lane.
Yeah. And if you have enough distance, everything looks 2D. So that's also one of the tricks with some of these illusions. If you're far enough away, but if you get close, yeah, because you have two eyes, well, most people do, it breaks it.
And also because of the stretching, right? Like, it's weird. It's not like it suddenly appears. It looks like a child in the middle of the street. You're seeing stretch objects. Oh, okay, I guess it looks like a child. Like, your brain, it's not going to shock your brain the same way because it's already slowly acclimating to something weird in the street. Might as well just put a light there. Like a flashing light.
Or some rumbles, bumps.
Rumbling would be good.
Yeah, no one wants to break their tires.
The Oculus Hall up in the Seattle office has a perspective thing in the painting. Has a perspective painting in the hallway where it says Oculus, but it goes across the walls and then across the back wall and across the other wall.
All right. That does it for our technology news segment. Before we continue on, I want to thank the other sponsor of this week's episode, and that's RoboForm. How many of you still use the same password for everything? I hope not a lot of you, because reusing password is the easiest way to have your data and identity stolen, and letting browsers automatically save your login information isn't secure enough in today's day and age. And thankfully, there are more ways and more secure ways, more convenient solutions than doing that. So RoboForm actually stores and generates strong, unique passwords right in your browser or mobile device. All you need to remember is one RoboForm master password. Pretty easy. And with RoboForm, you always have the right password, one click away, with a secure online vault, and it'll even auto-fill out long checkout forms. It's a password manager that's available for individuals, families, and businesses, and supports all major desktop and mobile platforms. So just go to RoboForm.com, and you can download today on the App Store or on iOS or Android. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your RoboForm Everywhere subscription when you use the promo code TEST, just T-S-T. You can simplify and secure your online journey today with RoboForm Password Manager, and thank them for supporting this week's episode.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
We had to cut our virtual reality discussion short last week because we were running short on time, and there was so much to talk about because we had just come back from Oculus Connect 4. What did we leave out that we want to revisit, Jeremy?
Oh my gosh! Well, we touched on the Go, which was the big news. Yes. $200 headset.
Yes.
We didn't touch on something that somebody brought up on Twitter, which is that how great that'll be for education.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point.
And I think, you know, Oculus is talking about the internal debates about whether a 3 degree of freedom headset would be poisoning the well. Right, like whether that's that ship has sailed. But yeah, I think there are so many people like can step up.
That
well
has been poisoned. I mean,
guess what? It was turned out to be more Kool-Aid than poisoned.
Well, maybe. I don't know. I still run into when I have, you know, friends and family come over and I've got my little Oculus set up downstairs, and you know, I say, oh hey, do you want to go try this out? And they're like, oh, well, I've tried VR, and I'm like, Have you tried
the 6 degrees of freedom with controllers?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that I tried, and they're describing basically 360 video, and I'm like,
Cardboard.
I have Google Cardboard. That's it. And so
I put my phone in that thing before.
but that is the experience that I think most people have had, and so it is poisoning the well. I mean, because they go, oh yeah, that kind of made me a little sick, and wasn't that compelling. So was it
the fact that it was a phone experience with maybe not the best audio, not the best frame rate, not the best content?
All the above.
Yeah. Or was it the fundamental three degrees of freedom versus an interaction? I think interaction is probably the biggest thing.
I mean, you can get some interaction if you've got your VR with some sort of input device. But even still, it's such a different thing. I mean, even when, going from Oculus with a Microsoft, controller to,
touch
controller, that was such a big leap.
Yeah.
I think that well has been poisoned. I say that jokingly, but I don't think we can recover from that. It's just going to take a little bit more time.
But they're not investing in recovering from that. I mean, they are in making the Rift cheaper and developing things like the Santa Cruz prototype, but they're also talking about a mass market product at $200 that is in that same category, degrees of freedom.
It's because their market, I think what they've learned is people aren't spending, $800 on a headset that has to then have a $1,000 to $2,000 computer behind it. That's really what it boils down to. I mean, and that's just cost. Yep. Yep. So,
and $200 all in is, even if what you're getting is not the best experience,
it's still
compared to what's out there. I think they also invest in a lot of content.
Yeah.
And
they're building up a library. I mean, they put huge. I mean, we've all seen they're huge amounts of investment in all of these content providers. Mm-hmm. And they are building their content for kind of the lowest common denominator, which is frustrating for, those of us that have these kind of bigger rigs. It's like, oh, we're getting kind of just this trickle of, of content.
We want the frontier more and more. And they're like mass market. They're doing both. The thing that always surprises me is how much John Carmack is into things like 360 photos.
Yeah, I don't get it.
And 360 video as like, I don't enjoy watching 360 video. I mean, I if it's well designed, they're interesting, but like, it's not something that I think about doing when I go home.
I don't want more. So that's kind of the benchmark for me. It's like, okay, if I spend 10 minutes on something and I take off my headset, in 10 minutes am I going to go, I want some more of that? And if it's 360 video or some of these other experiences that are just not well designed or make me a little bit sick, I'm like, no, I've had my fill. I'm all good.
Even if it's a well designed, a novel thing, like, okay, I've had, that's it.
Yeah. But then there's the Echo Arena experience or some of those like, you're like, oh my gosh, that viscerally, like, I need some more of that. I don't get that with those sorts of experiences. And that's the poison. That is it.
Are you surprised that Carmack is as invested in the mobile space as he is compared to the PC space?
I'm not, because I think he fundamentally believes that there is the way to get to mass market adoption in 6 degrees is to start with 3 degrees of freedom. And that the technical challenges on the mobile space are more interesting probably to him.
I think that's actually it. I think that's why he likes the mobile side, not necessarily 360 video so much, but he sees it as a optimization puzzle of how do I get that same coolness in limited hardware. I mean, that is his, like, his roots.
But his roots were also pushing the frontier and giving the best and the highest NPC and delivering for people who had, even back then, with Quake, $2,000 computers.
Yeah, but I could run,
He wasn't jumping in the mobile games when apps.
No,
right?
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't doing what John Romero was doing. Well,
Doom RPG. And he worked on that.
Right, right. Yeah. And I completely agree. There is a technical challenge there. Like, based on his talk that we saw, he was super excited about ways to optimize rendering a video for 360.
For mobile.
Right, for mobile. And optimizing, and whether it's streaming. And I guess he did some of that with his id Tech engines, like the mega texture stuff that he did, right? It's just super, super interesting to me.
I think he sees that there's a lot of talented people working in the space right now, and so he sees that that's where his
contributions.
Yeah, his contribution wants to. That's where he wants to make it.
Mm.
I think, like you said, like, he sees mobile as the future,
right?
And that's where he wants to spend his time.
And Zach, to your point about what makes an experience like Echo Arena, an interactive 6 degrees of freedom, high end experience at Echo Arena, more appealing, things you want to revisit over watching a 360 video. I think the big one other big differentiating factor is that is cross-compatible is just the social experience.
Sure.
I think that once you get $200 headsets, even if they're 3 degrees of freedom headsets, into, let's say, 5 million people's hands, it's a high number. It's a short number on the way to a billion, but it's a lot of more people than have
than
them
we
now,
have now yeah.
right, using on a regular basis, and have social 360
have a reason to be there.
Yep, with other people, that gives the network effect. The network effect will take over.
I'm most intrigued by the Go because it is a VR exclusive device. It's not like Cardboard or right. Gear VR in that you have to launch something or insert something and then get into a certain mode. It's drag and drop.
So you know, user experience, convenience, ease of use.
Yeah. I mean, I want to put that thing on and just I'll just be in VR instantaneously and I'll just be able to launch things. It'll be a VR device.
Right.
We haven't seen that since like the Nintendo thing, Virtual Boy.
That was such a big hit.
It's also the same argument for, you know, why we like the Switch. The one thing you can throw in your bag, take on a trip, right. Fly to a hotel, and if you're disconnected, you know, from your family, put that on, and maybe you can do a 360, some type of video chat with your family.
Portability, I think, is big. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. It's a portable device, and also the price. I think it really just comes down to price.
Yep.
And their argument is, more people will mean that we have more, we have the ability and a market to produce these bigger, more exciting pieces of content as well as hardware.
I don't know. Back to the education thing, though, I think it could be phenomenal. I mean, I think that was the promise of Cardboard, but that was such a bad experience. And that didn't end up being so cheap.
$200 is expensive for, like, getting them in classrooms, so. Like, Cardboard is still has the edge on, like...
Well, you're leveraging a phone. Somebody's already paying.
With a basically essentially a free adapter for the phone, every family can...
I don't know. Like, Oculus donated a headset to all the public libraries around the Bay Area. I could see them doing the same thing with the Go to get it in schools. I mean, they want to lock these kids in early, like McDonald's.
For education, though, I think there's actually a bigger push for things like AR, because there is that direct interaction with teachers and other students and things that we don't have the technology yet in VR to have.
And AR, you mean right now, is right now holding the phone up.
Holding the phone up and actually...
pass through system.
Yeah. So
the window.
So that seems to be a more approachable kind of educational realm is that AR, that app.
Well, VR doesn't seem to be feeling a lot of pressure from AR right now.
No, none at all.
At least in the consumer marketplace, there's nothing out there.
But there's
even
nothing
we all know that AR is where we all want to end up, because VR is just a subset of AR. AR with the screen blocked out.
Maybe soon we might have some AR competition.
Maybe we have no products. We haven't heard of any product announcements yet. But more funding for Magic Leap. They just raised another $500 million.
That's nuts.
For on the promise that they're going to have this AR headset.
Something.
God, I hope it's good.
So I think that doubles what they've raised.
No. I think it adds another 25% because I think they're now up to 2 billion.
Oh my God.
I don't know. According to Wikipedia, it has raised more than 540 million from Google, Qualcomm, Andreessen Horowitz. So like the original funders.
It's a lot of money. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they're valued at over, many billions.
That's crazy. With no product. It better. I mean,
it must be a good demo.
People must.
Seriously.
They're smart people. This blows my mind, right? Like, VCs who are willing to put their money in things, they must have seen. They must have some experience with what's out there.
Yes.
And an understanding of the technology, or advisors who understand the technology.
I've talked to people and they said it was cool. I've talked to people who have experienced it and they said that, and that's it. They're like, I can't say anything else. It was cool.
So, I mean, it's win-win for us as consumers, right?
If it ever comes out.
The options are, one, it comes out and it is cool.
Yes.
That's great. Two, it's completely like vaporware. Not our money that we came into. We had zero
investment
into the future. All existing rich people, their money, it's their money, right? What we don't want is they invested so much that they forced something bad to come out just to try to make some money back.
But I can't imagine
that sets the entire industry back.
But I can't imagine at this point they would just push something out the door.
The longer they wait, the more competition there is.
Yeah. And the longer they wait, the more pocket invested they are in trying to get something out to recoup something. now that there's already this mystique, this buzz.
Yeah.
Like, I'd say take your time, get the funding.
Do it
If your core technology is sound, then we're happy to wait. Because, you know, Apple wasn't ready to jump in the game. They're being smart in developing the software infrastructure and getting developers to work at the existing pass-through systems so they can have an understanding of the user interaction models, and also maybe this stuff all gets imported to whatever system they make in the future.
Well, and you know, is there? It's funny, like, the only other real competitor that I could think of is HoloLens to this in a real AR. And it's like, yeah, they released a product, but I haven't heard any buzz about...
Well, they intentionally said no HoloLens 2. They said it's not... It's B2B. Great for B2B. You know what? We're going to step back. We had a lead in it. We have our inside-out tracking. Let's not force something to the consumer that we think that isn't... I mean, and this is smart. I think this is really smart of them not to try to push something to market just to be first.
Right.
Like, well, make something good, not something first.
I mean, they were first.
They were. They got a lot of buzz.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just interesting that they pulled back, and I'm wondering what that means for something like Magic Leap, like the fact that maybe it isn't as compelling as, you know.
I think it's a really hard problem, and everyone's realizing that how hard and how expensive a problem it is.
They pulled back, but they also just launched 5 headsets.
In VR.
Yeah, but they call it HoloLens technology.
Wow. I think they have their tracking technology in there for Inside Out, that's it. Yeah.
Which is good. It's great. I'm glad that the fruits
they took,
of that
they took
research,
the best part of it.
Yep. The thing that worked the best, because we'd use, you know, Meta and their SLAM system, and HoloLens, I thought, was still
better.
It
was rock solid. It was nice.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple other bits in VR. Did we talk about TBCast? TBCast for Oculus? So they announced when we were at OC4 that they are going to support the Rift. This is the wireless system, transmitter system accessory, $250.
So that's a different SKU?
I don't know. I really hope it's not. But if you're in the market where you already have 2 headsets, like, they want to milk as much money from you as possible.
Here's my big problem with add-ons, and unfortunately, Oculus really didn't plan for this. The cables, the big heavy cable that goes from your head all the way back to your computer that's like 15 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing TPCast, where's that cable going to go? Is it going to bundle up on the back of my head? So, like, I have...
Oh, I think they come with new cables.
But I can't replace... It's hard. It's,
the Oculus ones are hard.
The Oculus are that's what I'm saying. Oculus didn't plan for this accessory. And it is... You're going to be... Just the added weight of having to carry that whole cable around. I was actually playing with that the other day. I'm like, wait a minute.
Wrap it around your waist.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's going to be a fashion accessory.
It's a belt. I'll Kickstarter a clip that will clip it.
Ooh, there you go.
A belt buckle.
There you go.
Right? Oculus, a big O belt buckle that you can work. Yeah.
I like it.
I mean, it's...
Go ahead.
It's products like this that mean the Rift 2 will not be wireless. You know, if we can upgrade to wireless, it means that Rift 2...
Hopefully the Rift 2 will have a replaceable cable. That's all I'm asking for.
I don't think that's the biggest deal. I mean, you might bundle it up, a little lasso in your belt.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the pros and cons from a product design prototyping standpoint, Zach? You think of having, is there any real pro to having it be a locked-in cable at the headset part?
Just one less connector, but there's lots of ways around that. I mean, like, we're good with connectors now. HDMI seems pretty good. I mean, you'd need to have some other, you know, secondary locking system because, again, that moves around a whole bunch.
Because it's a single cable.
It's a single cable.
On the other side, which is nice.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, and there's lots of ways of doing that. You can do an overmolded multi-connector cable. You can do all kinds of different things. But, I think...
The pros of being wireless far outweigh any... You know, hassle of having the cable
I think the biggest thing is going to be battery life. Like, so many portable electronics, that's going to be the thing. And then just management and, like, is it a removable battery? And do I have to, you know, pause for, you know, 6 hours while the thing charges? I mean, that's really what it boils down to, is that end user experience with it. Is that, you know, is that worth it?
Yeah.
And then speaking of AR kit again and Apple and AR, so there's this interview, I guess, was this with The Independent? Tim Cook talked about ARKit quite a bit.
I didn't read this.
No, who shared this? Someone shared it.
not it.
Wow.
Kishore. God damn it, Kishore.
Foiled again.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about this tonight. Have you guys used ARKit on your phones?
Just a couple demos.
Yeah, I just downloaded a couple of them. When I got my 8, I'm like, ooh, let's try some, you know, the IKEA app and a couple of those other things.
Do you have the
things.
Plus?
Yeah.
So you,
oh no, not the plus. I just have just the standard size,
and it works well with the one camera.
Yeah, it works really. I mean, I was really impressed with just like the measuring stuff and the way that it's doing you know, that's actually doing tracking. There's a couple of demos where you can kind of turn on all the debug information where it's actually showing you the points that it's tracking. I was just really fascinated with that, and the fact that they can do that with one camera as well as they do.
I've only tried it on my 6S, and I've tried it in confined spaces that don't work as well. It likes a bigger room, I find. Mm. So I'd be curious to see your phone and see how it compares.
We can fire it up.
I mean, in the interview, basically he says AR is like what multi-touch was for interaction. Like AR is going to change the way we interact. It's in the next paradigm for human-computer interaction.
If we get a good interface for it. I mean, right now, holding this phone up isn't a good interface.
That's such a touch sell, right, for them, right? It's compelling. Like, you talk about all the great things and all the magic that is in terms of like the spatial recognition, the SLAM stuff. But the fact is, right now, we're still holding flat things up.
That's not what Tim's talking about. Tim's talking about something they haven't announced yet.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
He's selling the product today. He's selling developers are making it's working in ARKit today.
He doesn't care. He's just saying, don't worry about it. AR is going to be great.
Oh,
just wait.
That's so
trust in the Tim.
Wow. He knows their R&D. He knows how much money they have to spend on it. Yeah.
They have all the money.
They do have all the money. any last bits in the VR minute?
Well, you got to give it up for Space Pirate Trainer. Been around for a while now. Finally hit 1.0.
Version 1.0.
You've got a lot of new enemies in there if you haven't gone in and played for a while. It's worth visiting. There's a mothership that shows up around level 15. Quite difficult. Some brand new baddies, some new power-ups. And it's a solid game. You know, it never became like something bigger than standing on a platform and shooting stuff, but I still say
it's a good intro game.
It's the Galaga of VR.
Do you think it ever got too complicated in terms of how many weapons? Because it's a good intro game, but like it seems like all the advances they made were to cater to people who had... gotten really good at Space Pirate Trainer. And people got really, really good.
You get as far as you can. Yeah. I don't know if it got too... You know, it certainly is a hard game eventually, but anybody can play it for a few levels.
Right. It's the Pac-Man.
Yeah.
Right.
Galaga.
Or Galaga. Sorry.
Testing this week. Hey, what have you guys been testing?
You guys been testing anything lately? Anything new in your shops, in your life? iPhone 8, how's iPhone 8?
iPhone 8 is, coming from a 5, it's awesome. But then everybody that I talk to, it's like, oh, it's the same as a 6 or same as a 7. So there's no great, like, ooh, wow, look at this kind of thing. But it just works. It just kind of works well. And again, because it's, you know, the latest hardware with the latest software, it's, it's
have
a good match.
Have you tried the wireless charging?
I don't have a wireless charger. I don't have a Qi charger anywhere. So
I want to try that in my Bolt and see if it works.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Let's try that.
We can
do
that.
You have a wireless charger in the Bolt?
Yeah.
Built in.
Is it a Qi standard one?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is it on a horizontal plane?
It's not. It's a little sleeve that you put the phone into. I don't think the 10 would fit in it, but yours...
But the 8 should.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't the 10 fit in it?
It's bigger. It's between the regular and the plus.
Wait, the actual physical size? I heard it's almost the exact same thing.
As what? As the standard?
As the standard size.
As like the 6S?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was bigger.
I think it's thicker. I don't think it's bigger.
Well, I will do that research.
Things to try.
Oh, yeah. I mean, is there a CAD model?
People have already 3D printed. Yes.
Got to do that pocket test.
Thingiverse.
That's it.
I played a bunch of VR games last night looking for something interesting. I played the Talos Principle VR, which I never played the original game, you know, the standard mouse and keyboard, but it's a Crytek game, Cryteam. So I was interested. It's kind of good looking, not as good as you expect from those guys. And it's just kind of meh. I'm looking for the next great VR game. I want the next, you know, amazing thing that I fall in love with. I played X Rebirth for a few minutes. I don't know. It seems like Elite Dangerous is more my speed. Iron Wolf VR is kind of interesting. It's a submarine game.
Yeah.
Multiplayer. And that's a great idea. You're surrounded by all these big... tools and machinery that you can use, and it feels immersive. Like the lights go red when you go underwater. You can pull the periscope down and look around. You can fire torpedoes. You have to avoid. You have to be stealthy. It's fun. I haven't played that with somebody yet because, of course, there's nobody in the multiplayer servers.
Right.
But play with you guys sometime if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I always see your head pop up in my VR, but you're never on at the same time I am.
That's
so
weird.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, with the future Oculus Home, you can leave a post-it note in your VR space. Sorry, I missed you.
Yep.
How about 6 p.m. tomorrow? Of course, I've been laser cutting away on the Glowforge. Glowforge, the pro model, is doing a lot of long etches and long engraves. They just released some new software updates on their front end. So
yeah, turns out you do have to reboot the printer, or at least put it online. So you won't see these updates if you just go to the app, unless your printer has
been turned off and on.
Your Glowforge has been turned on since it was released.
Oh, very good. So most of them, if you have a Glowforge and they are shipping them now, at least the early backers, I think they improve their raster settings. So if you upload a bitmap, now you have a difference. I guess they're getting rid of the presets were like light raster, light engrave or dark engrave. Now it's like, it's more context sensitive. Are you rastering, is it a photo? You're etching a photo? Mm-hmm. Is your bitmap a photo or is your bitmap
a line drawing,
graphic art? And then their settings are catered to that. So I did some testing between photos and line drawings. And then doing some vector etch. I love vector etching.
Now, you've used other laser cutters before.
Yes.
And yeah. I'm curious. So it seems to be this, what I've heard, I haven't used the Glowforge, but there seems to be this kind of obfuscation of kind of control. And is there a way to get in and be like, I want to do it at 25% speed and 25%? So you still can go in and muck with it.
Yeah. So their presets, anytime you go to one of their presets, you can then go say manual control and it'll show you the corresponding manual settings that presets. They encourage you actually write that down. I encourage you write that down because their presets may change. Like they may get rid of their 6 months ago photo setting, which you might have really liked.
Right.
Because they want to make things transparent and just work. So you want to write those settings down. And it's more than just like for laser cutters, from what I understand, like you have speed and power. Mm-hmm. Those are mm-hmm. two primary settings.
Well, you also have pulses per inch. I don't know if you have that control as well.
You have, so they have a DPI setting.
Okay.
Right? So those for a raster, it's going to be those. I don't think
that's what that is.
And then there's also the density of how far it moves in the Y direction for each X pass.
So that's what we're thinking about. There is not pulses per inch. Their DPI is the equivalent to thickness. Vertical line, Y movement.
Right.
Isn't there a difference between the two laser technologies where one uses pulses and the other doesn't?
Why would... Yes.
So tube lasers are continuous. Glass tube lasers are continuous and metal lasers are pulses.
Right.
And so maybe the metal lasers...
You have a little bit more control over that.
Have the pulses.
That's right. I haven't used the tube laser in a laser cutter, but they've all been... Cinrad, aluminum tube lasers.
Or metal lasers.
Metal lasers, yeah.
So... you get like a DPI setting if you want, and which works really well if you want like the gradient engraves, right? If you want to upload a depth map essentially and have it do really deep cuts.
You can do some fancy stuff with that.
And then there's also the way they process your raster, because there's the two settings. It can be dots or a pattern, they call it. So this is a way they, because your image, like if you upload a 10 megapixel image, it's not going to look like 10 megapixels.
Right.
They need to do some processing on how you turn a pixel into a series of dots, essentially.
There used to be a program, I'm sure that's still out there, called the Rasterbaiter, that would take a bitmap image and then convert it into different kind of pre-process or post-process forms.
Right.
I wonder if it's similar to that.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to optimize it for what the laser is going to do. And so... there are some things that are going to work better for the dot system, and that all is given to you. You can like switch between those options.
Sounds like a work in progress.
It totally is. Like there are things that I just really want. I know it's in their pipeline. Like I want the ability to pause a laser cut, pause a job, right? If you're doing like a 2-hour job and like I need to step away to answer the door, like you're technically, I don't want to leave the room. Like I want just to pause it for half an hour. I guess it's coming, but I think it may have to do. And again, the Glowforge people, please correct me if we're wrong, but because of the cloud software, right? Because a lot of that stuff is set.
So you need Amazon Key so that when your door rings, they can come in while you're laser cutting.
While I'm laser cutting.
I just want to save manual settings. That shouldn't be too much to ask.
Yeah, you can't save. You can't make your own custom settings yet.
Lots of asks, but hey, it's a version one product, and again, these are all software things. So that's the cool thing about software.
That's the thing.
This can all change.
Like, that's some basic design. Like I was telling Jeremy, you can import a really great raster raster image, drag and drop a photo. It's gonna etch that photo in. It's gonna engrave that photo. But I want to cut it out of my
piece, well, you can't just draw a box or draw a circle. I want like some very basic primitives for cut lines. Let me draw a box and say, if you have a great web interface, let me draw a box and say, cut that out.
Right. But then they're also basically making a CAD or a 2D drawing package on top of that. And so that you can see why there's a lot of work to it.
That's a lot of engineering. That's totally a lot of work. I'm not asking for Tinkercad, just asking for a square and an ellipse.
There you go.
Right. And let me stretch cut lines by two dimensions or something.
But the fact is, you have a laser cutter at home.
I have it's one still, next to my computer.
It's like, still amazing.
The fact that I have a 4K monitor with a laser cutter and a VR headset.
We live in Star Trek.
And a 3D printer all in one room. They can all be working at the same time. That's mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. It is.
Very cool. So we'll be doing more testing with that. Lots of people have great ideas. Like, I think the trick that I'm finding is try to get out of your system, the standard laser cut things, right? Mm. Like I'm getting all the line art, get all the etching, engraving photos, like, and start thinking of like, what does it mean to do mixed media? What does it mean to use a laser cutter to cut felt or to cut foam, or to combine it or fabric or different materials and combine it with what you can do with a 3D printer, right? If you design in your models like recesses to do
inlays
for laser cut pieces, how do you start building when you start combining
materials?
It's powerful
stuff. I mean, you kind of get any tool. I mean, I collect tools, and it's, you know, each one of those gives me more capabilities. And it's inspiring. I look at all of these things as like, okay, now that I have one more bit of, you know, technology, I can do even more stuff. And like you said, layering, I think, is really the key.
Your wife, Danica, is a crafty maker. Has she shown an interest in the laser
cutter?
Yeah, we're
going to do some felt this weekend.
That's cool.
I recommend Micro Suede.
Micro Suede.
Yeah, so it's a synthetic suede-like material, but it has a really nice edge, and it also etches really cool. So you can etch the micro suede. It gives you good contrast. And then for being a fabric, it works really nicely.
And you can buy it online.
You can.
Very cool. Awesome. Thanks for the recommendation.
Sure.
Anything else you guys want to talk about in terms of what we've been testing?
I've been, my latest thing has been teaching. I started teaching a class over at a college over in Oakland, and I've been testing all kinds of hardware to teach people how to build things. And that's been a fun, it's funny, you kind of get out of the sort of hobby world when you're doing things professionally, and then every once in a while you kind of peek over the fence and you go, hey, what's the latest in Arduino, and what's the latest in sort of all these little, you know, project boards and what's out there. And it's amazing. I mean, in a year or two of not paying as close attention as I should, there's all kinds of cool wearable devices and little boards that support all the latest chips. You know, when there's a new MP3 decoder or some new light sensor or some new, there's always this, you know, kind of new crop of hardware that comes out. So, you know, going through SparkFun and Adafruit's website and just kind of seeing what's out there has been a lot of fun. And I now have an excuse to sort of browse and say, oh, I should try these out. So lots of little bits of hardware, been lots of fun.
Something I couldn't find from either of those guys was a galvanic skin response measuring system.
Yeah.
But I found one at Seed.
Oh, Seed is great.
In China.
Yeah.
So I bought a couple of those, and super cheap, like $30.
You're going to hook them up to your kids to find out if they're telling lies?
Yes.
Excellent. You can grill them.
Oh, great.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Zach, for coming by.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Where can people find you online?
BuildCoolStuff.com. I don't do a lot on the social medias much. I do have a Twitter account, which I think is BuildCoolStuffZach. I don't even remember what it is. If you need to get a hold of me, BuildCoolStuff.com. There's lots of links on there to email.
All right. Thank you again. We got to have you back, and we'll get that full origin story. I mean, people, they love having you on, and
awesome.
We love having you on.
I love being here.
And we love hearing about things you make. And if you're in town in San Francisco this Saturday, please come by and check us out. We're at the Castro Theater at 7 p.m. Tickets are as low as $15 if you want to watch us do some stuff on stage. Adam has a really great talk that he's going to give. Good presentation. So hope to see you there. Tickets are at tested2017.eventbrite.com. And until then, we have an outro
from Ben L.
All right, here we go.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
There was nothing underneath her. It was amazing. It was amazing.
Were you on drugs?
Test it. Bite. Build stuff. Zach.
There you go. That's my Twitter.